Note here again that the government which is attempting to resurrect or to rehabilitate the reputation of Mussolini is a government involving these fascist ministers, and that these fascist ministers come from the MSI, because we're going to be taking a look at how the MSI was able to successfully perpetuate the fascism of Benito Mussolini, and to perpetuate it in such a way as that eventually that fascism could begin to reemerge into the light of day, and is now, to a large extent at least, achieved or has grasped the reins of political power in Italy. Another article from the Searchlight, a different issue, I'm not going to read the article, just going to allude to it, this comes from the Searchlight of April of 1994. Research credit on the following also goes to a listener. One of the things that we looked at from the, in the past, in the from the April 1994 Searchlight, is an article about a youth branch of the MSI called the Movimento Politico. This is a youth group, a youth fascist group that was created by the MSI, but is now deviating from the political line of the MSI and the National Alliance of Fini, a reworking of the MSI. For the time being, MSI is rejecting a program of violence to achieve full political power for the fascists in Italy. The Movimento Politico, however, wants to engage in that type of violence. In an article entitled Young Fascists Reject MSI's New Refined Image, we saw the description of the Movimento Politico, who favor the sort of violent political action that is espoused by Stefano Della Chiai. Now, Della Chiai is the main author of the aforementioned Strategy of Tension. I would note that as we looked at in Radio Free America number 19, Stefano Della Chiai himself, again, the author of the Strategy of Tension to a large extent and one of its central participants, a key participant in the 1970 Borghese coup attempt. Stefano Della Chiai, again, who is described in the April 1994 Searchlight article, Young Fascists Reject MSI's New Refined Image. Stefano Della Chiai is the ideological hero of the MP, the Movimento Politico. As we saw on Radio Free America number 19, Stefano Della Chiai drew his political inspiration from, among others, a fellow named Léon de Grel, a Waffen-SS general and a Flemish fascist leader, who we will be talking about in weeks to come. Léon de Grel passed away recently. In Radio Free America number 19, we dealt with the counsel given to Stefano Della Chiai by Léon de Grel. Léon de Grel was one of the post-World War II leaders of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground, which to a large extent was able to perpetuate the fascism of Hitler and also to a lesser extent of Mussolini as well, underground, in such a way as that now that fascism is beginning to reemerge into the light of day. Again, notes the connections and the support for people like Stefano Della Chiai and the Strategy of Tension by our own intelligence system. Note that in the person of people like Léon de Grel, we find elements of direct historical continuity between the fascism of the Hitler-Mussolini period and the fascism of the contemporary period, the fascism that is now an official part of the Italian government, the fascism that is now issuing postage stamps, attempting to resurrect the reputation of fascists, the fascism, unfortunately, which Johnny and Janie still cannot recognize, or maybe even less capable of recognizing than they were before. As I mentioned, in Radio Free America program number 19, we dealt with the Strategy of Tension, we dealt with the P2 Lodge, we dealt with Stefano Della Chiai, and in Radio Free America shows 19, 20, and 21, among others, as well as Radio Free America shows 32, 34, and the miscellaneous archive show dealing with Operation Gladio, we dealt with the prominent support of elements of the post-World War II American national security establishment for fascism. In the aforementioned archive show called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, we dealt with American support for fascism in the pre-World War II and also to a lesser extent in the World War II period. Again, Mussolini was viewed with great favor by many prominent American industrialists and financiers, as was Hitler. The eugenics thinking and the eugenic social philosophy and legislation, which was the foundation for the Third Reich's extermination programs, was not only viewed with great favor by many prominent American social and political thinkers, but was put into effect to a large extent in the United States. Well, after the war, many of the most heinous elements of fascism were resurrected and put right back into power and perpetuated as a result of the collaboration of many of the Western nations, which had actually been at war with fascism. Because even though those nations were at war with fascism, many of the most powerful elements within those nations were pro-fascist. We're going to take a look briefly at the reconstitution of Italian fascism by elements of U.S. national security, including CIA and American elements of NATO, in the post-World War II period. We're going to take a look at an article from the current edition of Covert Action Quarterly. Now, the address for Covert Action Quarterly is 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. Once again, Covert Action Quarterly, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. We're going to take a look at a section of an article entitled Gladio, The Secret U.S. War to Subvert Italian Democracy. This article is by Arthur E. Rouse, R-O-W-S-E, who's described here as a freelance writer formerly on the staff of the Washington Post and U.S. News and World Report. This article about Operation Gladio by Arthur Rouse goes into the reconstitution of Italian fascist elements in the post-World War II period with the connivance of the United States in order to combat communism. And indeed, as we saw in Radio Free America number 37, the Nazis themselves learned to use anti-communism, doctrinaire anti-communism, as a vehicle for conquest. We're going to take a look at that in a big, big way in the broadcast this evening. In Operation Gladio, by the way, we should briefly sum up what Operation Gladio is. This was a contingency plan to, ostensibly at least, a contingency plan to set up guerrilla groups and a clandestine anti-communist infrastructure to harass a potentially successful in communist invasion army in Western Europe, also probably elsewhere. But the contingency plan to set up clandestine political networks, and in particular clandestine military networks, in order to wage guerrilla war against a successful Soviet invasion of Western Europe, was actually used to launch a program of fascist terror. The inspiration for Operation Stay Behind, which was the parent program of which the Italian Gladio was an offshoot, that was the brainchild and the godchild, so to speak, of the aforementioned Nazi intelligence chief Reinhard Gehlen. We took a look at that in the aforementioned Seeds of Nuremberg archive show. So that's what Operation Gladio is. We're going to take a look now at the genesis of Operation Gladio, the CIA's role in helping to reconstitute Italian fascism, and to put right back into power some of the very Italian fascists that had been unseated, ostensibly at least, by the Allied military occupation of Italy and the ostensible defeat of fascism. Arthur Rouse writes as follows in Gladio, The Secret U.S. War to Subvert Italian Democracy. The program in Italy was aimed at the threat that communists might mount an insurrection or gain a share of political power through the ballot box. An insurrection was unlikely, however, since nearly all posts in the bureaucracy were filled after the war by solidly anti-communist veterans of Mussolini's forces with Allied approval. It is against the background, of course, of the reconstitution of Italian fascists and fascism that the P2 Lodge and its successful blossoming into the Berlusconi right-wing fascist coalition should be viewed. Bear in mind that Licio Gelli, head of the P2, an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration, also somebody who worked with the CIA. During the war, they are skipping down in this article. During the war, most Americans considered themselves heroes who freed Western Europe from its brutal Nazi and fascist rulers. It wasn't long after the American landings on Italian soil, however, that the White Hats got sullied. While some OSS agents worked with anti-fascists to help lay the basis for Italian democracy, many of those higher up the ladder conspired with backers of Mussolini or the former king to impede it. Although many European intelligence agencies have admitted participating, the CIA has denied any connection with Gladio. But enough information has emerged to show that the CIA sponsored and financed a large portion of the terrorism and disruption that plagued Italy for nearly half a century. Among other things, the U.S. government forged secret alliances with the mafia and right-wing elements of the Vatican to prevent the left from playing any role in government, recruited Mussolini's ex-police into paramilitary bands, secretly financed and trained by the CIA, ostensibly to fight Soviets but really to conduct terror attacks blamed on the left, employed the gamut of psychological warfare tactics, including paying millions in slush funds to political parties, journalists, and other influential contacts to tilt parliamentary elections against the left, created a secret service and a parallel government structure linked to the CIA, whose assets attempted several times to overthrow the elected government, and targeted Prime Minister Aldo Moro, who was later kidnapped and murdered under mysterious circumstances after offering to bring communists into the government. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, provided international cover for Washington's post-war operations in Italy. A secret clause in the initial NATO agreement in 1949 required that before a nation could join, it must have already established a national security authority to fight communism through clandestine citizen cadres. This stay-behind clause grew out of a secret committee set up at U.S. assistance in the Atlantic Pact, the forerunner of NATO. Each NATO member was also required to send delegates to semi-annual meetings on the subject. Once again, because we're going to see in this provision, the secret provision of the NATO treaty, we're going to see an echo of the formation of clandestine fascist cells in various places, ostensibly to fight communism and moral decay, but actually to spread fascism. In taking a look at the political pedigree of French Prime Minister François Mitterrand, something we're going to be doing at considerable length, we're going to come across his connections to French fascism, and in particular to an organization called the Cagoule, or the Les Cagoulards, a clandestine fascist organization in France in the pre-World War II period, with very profound connections to many of the most influential elements in French society, including and especially people within the French military who later became key functionaries of the Vichy collaborationist government that, of course, worked with the Nazis. The Cagoulards, Les Cagoulards, the so-called Hooded Ones, were a clandestine fascist organization organized into small groups of very active and heavily armed fascists who attempted to overthrow the French government in 1937 and 38. That government finally did fall, and its successor government was subverted to a large extent from within by many of the same fascists that had been active in the Cagoulard movement. So take note again of one of the things that was the can be viewed as the operational parent of Project Gladio, or Operation Gladio, or Operation Stay Behind, its parent program. Once again, from Covert Action Quarterly, this, by the way, the number 49 from the summer of 1994. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, provided international cover for Washington's post-war operations in Italy. A secret clause in the initial NATO agreement in 1949 required that before a nation could join, it must have already established a national security authority to fight communism through clandestine citizen cadre. This, quote, stay behind, unquote, clause grew out of a secret committee set up at U.S. insistence in the Atlantic Pact, the forerunner of NATO. Each NATO member was also required to send delegates to semi-annual meetings on the subject. Of course, that program led directly to Gladio and also to the conditions that led to the rise of the P2. Continuing, U.S. authority for such moves flowed in a steady stream of presidential directives transmitted through the National Security Council, or NSC. In December of 1950, the council gave the armed forces carte blanche to use, quote, appropriate, unquote, military force, even if the communists merely, quote, gained participation, unquote, in government by legal means, or, quote, threatened to achieve control or the government ceases to evidence a determination to oppose communist internal or external threats, unquote. The CIA helped the Italian police to set up secret squadrons staffed in many cases with veterans of Mussolini's secret police. The squadrons were trained for intensive espionage and counter-espionage against communists and other perceived enemies of the status quo. The plan to use, quote, exceptional means, unquote, was patterned after the highly militarized French intelligence service, the Sûreté Nationale, which was reportedly so tough on communists that many fled to other countries. The newly organized intelligence agency, CIFAR, S-I-F-A-R, began operations in September of 1949 under the supervision of an undercover American, Carmel Offi, O-F-F-I-E, nicknamed Godfather by the Italians. Interior Minister Mario Selba headed the operation. At the same time, Selba was directing a brutal repression, murdering hundreds of workers and peasants who sought improved conditions after the war. So note again that it was against the background of American support for residual Italian fascism and against the background of American assistance for the reconstitution of Italian fascism that the P2 Lodge and its operations culminating in the Berlusconi coalition government should be viewed. Of the P2, Arthur Rouse writes as follows. Skipping down in this particular article from Covert Action Quarterly, summer of 1994, number 49. Two ancient mysterious international fraternities kept the loosely flying Gladio programs from flying apart, or kept the loosely linked Gladio programs from flying apart. The Knights of Malta played a formative role after the war, see Box, but the Order of Freemasonry and its most notorious lodge in Italy, known as Propaganda Due, pronounced Due or P2, was far more influential. In the late 1960s, its most venerable master was Licio Gelli, a knight of Malta who fought for Franco with Mussolini's blackshirts. At the end of World War II, Gelli faced execution by Italian partisans for his Nazi collaboration, but escaped by joining the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps. In the 1950s, he was recruited by CIFAR. After some years of self-imposed exile in Argentine fascist circles, he saw his calling in Italy as a Mason. Quickly rising to its top post, he began fraternizing in 1969 with General Alexander Haig, then assistant to Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's national security chief. Gelli became the main intermediary between the CIA and the SID's De Lorenzo, also a Mason and a Knight of Malta. Gelli's first order from the White House was reportedly to recruit 400 more top Italian and NATO officials. To help ferret out dissidents, Gelli and De Lorenzo began compiling personal dossiers on thousands of people, including legislators and clerics. Within a few years, scandal erupted when an inquiry found 157,000 such files in SID, all available to the Ministers of Defense and Interior. Parliament ordered 34,000 files burned, but by then the CIA had obtained duplicates for its archives. And so again, the formation and growth of the P2 should be seen against the background of the American support for the reconstitution of fascism. And note that with the provision in the NATO Charter or in the Atlantic Pact for the setting up of secret or clandestine anti-communist cells in member nations, we are seeing an echo of the methodology of fascism, only this echo is resounding within the structure of the dominant national security body of the Cold War period, namely the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and in particular it is an echo of the methodological operational principles of fascism being put into practice, or resounding, I should say, through the U.S. intelligence system. And again, bear in mind the setting up of the clandestine anti-communist infrastructure and the setting up of clandestine anti-communist cells mandated by NATO. This was the parent of the Operation Gladio program. Gladio, in turn, leading to the operational reconstitution of Italian fascism, the strategy of tension, and ultimately the formation of P2, the growth of P2, and the evolution of the P2 into the fascist government of Italy, which basically is a reconstitution and a recapitulation of the government of Il Duce, the Il Duce that Johnny and Janie can't recognize. What we're going to do now is take a musical break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the historical continuity between the Italian fascism of the World War II, or one of the elements of historical continuity between the fascism of the World War II period and the fascism of today. That's something called the Malmo International. We're also going to take a look at an obituary and a description of the life of a Swedish fascist named Per Engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L, the father, the godfather, so to speak, of the Malmo International, something most people have not heard of, something that Johnny and Janie probably can't identify, but something which is very important in the development of the political nature of the modern world, and the Malmo International and its godfather, Per Engdahl, the Swedish fascist, recently deceased, very important in the development of the historical continuity and the operational continuity between the fascism of the World War II period and the fascism of today. Music, and then more of the prepared portion of tonight's program. We're going to continue with the prepared portion of tonight's program. What we're going to look at next concerns the obituary and, to a certain extent, a description of the life of a fellow named Per Engdahl, last name E-N-G-D-A-H-L. Now, Engdahl is a name that most people don't know much about. It's another name that Johnny and Janie can't identify, just like Il Duce. Unfortunately, Per Engdahl is a fairly important individual, one who, in a concert with his fascist compatriots around the world, has had a significant effect on contemporary history, and it is in part as a result of the efforts of Per Engdahl, and to a considerable extent as a result of the efforts of people like Per Engdahl, that organizations like the MSI, the direct successor to Mussolini's fascist party in Italy, the same Mussolini, the same Il Duce that Johnny and Janie can't recognize, it is for that reason that the MSI and its direct successor, the National Alliance, are in power today. The survival of and the successful perpetuation of the MSI and other fascist elements around the world is due to a considerable extent to the efforts, as I said, of not only Per Engdahl as an individual and with regard to his post-World War II efforts on behalf of international fascism, but also to the efforts of people like Per Engdahl. In order to hear about Per Engdahl and beyond that, in order to hear about the Malmo International, that's named from Malmo, Sweden, M-A-L-M-O, and then an umlaut over two dots over the O, we're going to turn once again to the Searchlight magazine. One more time, we'll give the address for people that would like to subscribe to this excellent anti-fascist monthly.
To subscribe to the Searchlight, a British anti-fascist publication, write to Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, or phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax 011-4471-284-4410. That's the Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, phone 011-4471-284-4040, or fax at 011-4471-284-4410.
And in the July 1994 issue of the Searchlight, there is an obituary and a description of the life of Per Engdahl. And we're going to talk now about Per Engdahl and the Malmo International, a fascist consortium and networking body that he founded. And we're going to take a look at how Per Engdahl and the Malmo International represent an element and elements of continuity and elements of the perpetuation of fascism from the World War II and pre-World War II periods right up until the contemporary, up through the contemporary time. From the July 1994 Searchlight, issue number 229, we find the following article. Its headlines, Funds Go to Swedish Terror Group After Engdahl Dies. The article reads in part, Per Engdahl, again, capital P-E-R, capital E-N-G-D-A-H-L, Führer of the New Swedish Movement, or NSM, died on May 15th, surrounded by his closest friends and relatives, his wife, children, a few boneheads from the Reich Front, and a gathering of leftover Swedish Waffen-SS volunteers. According to a knowledgeable source, one of 85-year-old Engdahl's last acts was to sign over the NSM bank account to a skinhead who plays a key role in the Storm Network. That's a modern Swedish fascist organization. A shrewd political organizer and talented tactician, Per Engdahl was one of those people whom you can say that his life was a complete waste of time. Born in 1909, by the way, this is the Searchlight's text. This is not any editorializing on my part. Continuing, born in 1909, Engdahl was one of the few remaining wartime fascist leaders in Europe. Although he was always an utter political failure on his home ground, he is one of the few, perhaps the only, Swedish fascist leader to enjoy significant prestige and respect among international Nazis. A student at the prestigious Uppsala University, Engdahl began his political career in 1928 when he joined the Swedish Fascist Struggle Organization, or SFKO. This group was led by Konrad Hallgren, H-A-L-L-G-R-E-N, a military officer who had been a soldier in the German army, where he had picked up early Hitlerite and Strasserite influences. Another SFKO leader was Sven Olof Lindholm, L-I-N-D-H-O-L-M, who was later to lead the most important Swedish wartime Nazi party, the National Socialist Workers' Party, or NSAP, later renamed the Swedish Socialist Assembly, or SSS. In the 1920s, the NSAP was very virulently anti-Semitic, especially after party leaders had wined and dined with the German Nazi leadership at its Nuremberg rally conference in 1929. Although Engdahl realized early on that brown shirt sentiments would never make much headway in Sweden, he never seriously opposed German Nazism. A shrewd tactician, Engdahl opted to support Italian fascism. In 1931, he became a local leader of a newly formed fascist organization, New Swedish People's Movement, that again the NSM. Following a brief period of expansion, the movement fell apart, with the majority returning to support German Nazism. Engdahl elected to remain on the outside and started to build his own organization, New Sweden. In 1937, Engdahl merged his organization with the ultranationalist and fascist Swedish National League, or SNF, and became deputy chairman of the combined group. The marriage lasted until 1941, when Engdahl broke off to form Swedish Opposition, a group he hoped would be a, quote, unifying popular front, unquote, in support of the new European order Hitler would build at the end of the war. Skipping down, after talking about the collapse of fascism at the end of World War II, or the collapse of the fascist states of Germany and Italy at the end of World War II, the Searchlight next goes into a discussion of Per Engdahl as a post-World War II leader in the underground networks of fascism. In particular, there are indications that Per Engdahl may have been involved with the northern elements of the Odessa. That's never been fully confirmed, but the evidence points in that direction. Of course, the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground, which worked not only with our own intelligence system, but which wielded a tremendous influence, although a largely unrecognized influence in the post-World War II world. And there is a successor organization to the Odessa, which not only, as we looked at in our July 10th broadcast, helps to finance neo-Nazis around the world. We're going to deal with that in future broadcasts. But the successor organization of the Odessa may very well have been involved in the recent bombings in Argentina and also Panama. I dealt with that in the July 24th, One Step Beyond, July 24th, 1994. Also in the August 28th, August 21st, and August 14th editions of One Step Beyond. Of Per Engdahl and his post-World War II work, quite possibly with the Odessa, certainly as a key functionary of the underground elements of post-World War II fascism, and perhaps underground belongs in quotes, because as we shall see, through the efforts of people like Per Engdahl, some of these elements were able to emerge into public view and to begin the march to the return to power that elements like the MSI have successfully realized in the person of the Berlusconi government. Continuing. Paradoxically, as his importance diminished in Sweden, Engdahl's prestige and importance grew rapidly in the international Nazi circuit after the war. A reason for this was, of course, that since Sweden had not participated in the war, Engdahl's organization remained intact. He could offer his hounded international Nazi friends an element of protection and shelter in Sweden. It is believed, although not proven, that Engdahl also became a link in the northern route of the so-called Odessa Network, the Nazi war criminals' escape route to South America. Immediately after the war, Engdahl became increasingly busy in reorganizing the Nazi structures in Europe. In 1947, the NSM organized the first post-war joint meeting of Nordic Nazi and fascist groups. The meeting was held in Copenhagen, and a year later, Engdahl had a hand in forming the Danish Reformbevegelse, modeled on the NSM. That's Reformbevegelse. Reformbevegelse is probably pronounced. Anyway, continuing. By the way, from time to time I will butcher words that are in languages I do not speak, and my Swedish is non-existent, unfortunately. So as I sight-read these, please bear with me. Continuing. In the late 1940s, the NSM was the clearinghouse in an intricate network linking surviving European Nazis together. NSM offered support to a variety of groups in Norway, Denmark, Germany, Belgium, Holland, Britain, France, and Spain. Engdahl was one of the first foreigners to form links with the reborn Italian fascist party, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, or MSI. One more time. Engdahl was one of the first foreigners to form links with the reborn Italian fascist party, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, or MSI. Of course, interrupting, MSI is the party which now has five ministers in the National Alliance faction of the Berlusconi coalition government. Continuing, when the MSI suggested the need to build a firm international fascist network, Engdahl became one of its key organizers. Next is a description of the so-called Brown International or Malmo International. This is a principal element of post-World War II fascism. This particular international fascist consortium formed by Per Engdahl and involving, among others, the aforementioned MSI. Continuing. The Brown International, better known as the Malmo movement, was very much Per Engdahl's brainchild. It was formed in May of 1951 at a meeting of key European fascist leaders in the southern Swedish city of Malmo. Among the participants in the conference were the MSA party leader Arturo Michelini, M-I-C-H-E-L-I-N-I, Johan van Dijk, D-Y-C-K, a leader of the Belgian Vlaamsbok, that's a Belgian fascist group, and Maurice Bardèche, a founder of the French fascist magazine Défense de l'Occident, one of the pioneers of the Nazi revisionism. By the way, Bardèche's name, B-A-R-D-E, accent grave, C-H-E. The German delegation was led by Dr. Franz Richter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R, also known as Fritz Rossler, R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T-S-S-L-E-R. He was a key organizer in General Otto Ernst Rehmer's Nazi organization, the Socialiste Reichspartei, which, before being outlawed, functioned partly as the public face of the Odessa Network. Also present was Karl-Heinz Priester, P-R-E-I-S-T-E-R, of the Deutsche Soziale Bewegung. It was at his suggestion that the international network was given the formal name Europäische Social Bewegung, the European Social Movement. Bewegung, by the way, B-E-W-E-G-U-N-G. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. By the way, Europäische is E-U-R-O-P-A-I-S-C-H-E. Continuing. Per Engdahl, who had long-standing links with the British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley, also helped launch the ESB organ Nation Europa, together with former SS officer Arthur Erhard, E-H-R-H-A-R-D. Now take note of this magazine, because we're going to come back to this later on in the broadcast. This magazine still exists today under the name Nation und Europa, and is considered to be one of the most important mouthpieces of the neo-Nazi movement in Germany. So note again, the Malmo International represented, or was, I should say, didn't represent, it was a meeting of key European fascist leaders in the city of Malmo in southern Sweden, at which a consortium was formalized, basically an operational network between some of the European fascist groups, one of the key elements in the so-called Malmo or Brown International, the MSI. And again, of course, the MSI is the parent out of the party out of which the National Alliance grew. The MSI is the party that put five ministers in the current fascist coalition government in Italy. And again, if Johnny can't recognize Il Duce, or Janie can't recognize or can't identify Il Duce, these people have their way. They'll be identifying Il Duce as a hero, kind of like the people who wanted to make Mussolini an honorary member of the American Legion. Remember the magazine Nation Europa, later Nation und Europa. This is a magazine we're going to come back to later. Note also that the German delegation to the Malmo International was headed up by Otto Ernst Rehmer. We've dealt with Rehmer in the past, his connections to the Odessa, his presence in Egypt, his work with people like Haj Amin al-Husseini, his work with the contingent of Nazi war criminals that was in Egypt as advisors to Nasser. They're that group having to a large extent been placed there as a result of a CIA Galen mission that we looked at last week. And note also that as we looked at in a supplement to Radio Free America number 37, Otto Ernst Rehmer was something of the political godfather to Ewald Altans, one of the key German Nazi leaders. Remember the name Altans, because in the person of people like Otto Ernst Rehmer and Ewald Altans, we are again seeing the direct political and operational continuity between the fascism of the World War II period and the fascism today, Altans being one of the key so-called neo-unquote Nazi leaders of contemporary Germany. So remember Per Engdahl, his probable work as a northern link in the Odessa network, his certain work as an organizer of the Malmo or Brown International from 1951 on, one of the networking associations for post-World War II European fascism and world fascism beyond that. And note also the magazine that was founded by Per Engdahl and that he helped to launch with a former SS officer, Arthur Erhard. That made that magazine formerly Nation Europa, the magazine of the European Social Movement, an Italian, fascist consortium, a fascist body, basically, founded by Per Engdahl at the Malmo International. Note this magazine is now called Nation und Europa, and we're going to come back to that later on in the discussion. More about Per Engdahl and the Malmo International, one of the institutions which helped to perpetuate fascism and which, along with Per Engdahl himself, represents one of the elements of historical, political, and operational continuity between the fascism of the World War II period, such as the original SS and Waffen-SS, and the original fascisti of Mussolini, and the contemporary fascists, such as the various Nazi parties of Germany and their clandestine unifying structure, and also institutions like the MSI, the National Alliance, and the right-wing fascist coalition currently governing Italy. We're going to take a look now at a book called Fascism Today, subtitled A World Survey, co-authored by two Italian writers, Angelo Del Boca and Mario Giovanna. Del Boca, capital D-E-L, capital B-O-C-A, and Giovanna, capital G-I-O-V-A-N-A. Now, today, by the way, is 1969. So when this book, by the way, published in hardcover by Pantheon Books, a division of Random House, this hardcover edition of Fascism Today is talking about fascism today at about the same time as the Woodstock Festival took place. This book is 25 years old, so bear that in mind. But there is some excellent material in here about the Malmo or Brown International. In a section of the book called Fascism Today, called the Malmo International, we find the following, skipping down. This dream of reconstructing the European Empire, which Hitler during the war years had merely hewn in the rough, was not, however, approved by all the neo-fascist groups. The more powerful organizations, such as the Movimento Sociale Italiano, or MSI, and the Deutsche Reichspartei, or DRP, were in fact busy making a fresh start in the hope of winning over at least a part of the electorate, and at all events officially had resigned themselves to playing the democratic game. The notions of a brutal socialism and Europe as a third force were thus cultivated by the smaller groups consisting of nostalgics and extremists. And in the course of the last 20 years, it is these radical groups who have created the dozen or so internationals of whose existence we know. Naturally, the MSI and the DRP also sent their delegates to the European Congresses, but without showing much enthusiasm and without compromising themselves too deeply, thus justifying Bardesh's claim that, quote, for the majority of fascists, nationalism is still the mainspring of their doctrine and feelings. At a first meeting of exponents of the various neo-fascist and neo-Nazi parties and movements took place in Rome in March of 1950. But at this conference, which was organized by the MSI and some representatives of Swedish fascism, no important decisions were made except that another meeting should be held, if possible, in a climate less hostile to demonstrations of this sort than Rome. In fact, the choice fell upon Malmo, a quiet little town in the extreme south of Sweden, where for many years a great admirer of Mussolini, Per Engdahl, had been running the Nisvensa Rora Rorelsen fascist party and establishing a periodical called Vagen Fremat without being molested. That's V-A-E-G-E-N-F-R-A-M-A-T. At the end of May 1951, about 100 delegates from the principal German, Italian, Austrian, French, Spanish, Hungarian, and Swedish parties and groups assembled at Malmo. Among those present, Sir Oswald Mosley was the only man who held an important post in the defunct Nazi and fascist parties. We must, however, note the presence of Maurice Bardèche, who had placed his pen at the disposal of the neo-fascists after his brother-in-law, Robert Brasillach, B-R-A-S-I-L-L-A-C-H, had been shot. At Malmo, Bardèche represented the Comité National Français. In addition to this professor of literature, author of a learned degree thesis on Balzac, others present included a former leader of the Hitlerjugend, Karl-Heinz Priester, who had some connection with the SS International, Professor Ernesto Massi, who shortly afterwards broke away from the MSI, and the German Fritz Rossler, who, after the banning of the Socialista Reichspartei, took refuge in Egypt. These men, whose backgrounds and pasts had been so different, founded the European Social Movement, which later became more widely known as the Malmo International. This European Social Movement advocated a third force Europe and claimed to be anti-communist, but it was nevertheless an abstract creation of moderates like Mosley and literary men like Bardèche, rather than an answer to the dreams of the younger generations who demanded action and were steeped in racialist ideas which were far too openly professed and compromising. This archetype of neo-fascist internationals, however, soon found itself in difficulties and lost the support of its right wing, which in September 1951 founded at Zurich the Nouvel Ordre Européen, or NOE, an international organization characterized by its extreme and virulent anti-Semitism. As for the European Social Movement, which is still under the leadership of Per Engdahl, it still keeps in touch with about 40 neo-fascist groups in a dozen or more countries. But in the course of 15 years, it has never succeeded in consolidating its structure or exerting influence on a European scale. Note, however, that elements like the MSI and participants like Otto Ernst Rehmer, the godfather of current German neo-Nazi leader Ewald Altans, the Malmo International and Per Engdahl, and its newspaper, the Nation und Europa, have in fact realized, as I said, a direct historical, operational, and political continuity from the Hitler and Mussolini period to the fascism of today, that fascism now obviously again in power to a considerable extent in Italy. What we're going to do next is take a look at a story which broke yesterday, September 3rd of 1994, in the San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers. This concerns the political pedigree, and in particular the World War II and fascist collaborationist background, of the current Prime Minister of France, François Mitterrand. Now, that not only raises some very interesting questions about President Mitterrand himself and some of his political actions and also his current status as head of a France which is growing increasingly close to Germany, the examination or unexamination of the political pedigree of François Mitterrand of necessity will examine the fascist political milieu of which he was a part.